Thanks, Nathan, for your invitation to come to be here this evening, and thanks everyone for just the opportunity to share with you in the liturgy and in the silence and the opportunity to slow down. It's been very refreshing tonight. I want to break this up into three sections, what I'm going to say tonight. The first is, what was she thinking? A friend rang me. It was several years since she'd become a Christian. Unfortunately for her, things weren't going well at her work. She had a poor relationship with her supervisor, and it made her very anxious about her job and going into work. On the domestic front, she was still looking for Mr. Right, and she wasn't having any success. And in her wider family, she lamented that she'd stopped speaking to one of her brothers and didn't get on with the other one's wife. Earlier in her career, she'd been able to start buying an apartment, but she'd sold it and moved overseas to work on what she believed was God's call to her. But things didn't work out overseas, and now she was back in Australia, and she was financially much worse off. We talked for a while, and then she said, "Phil, I don't get it. Wasn't I supposed to get abundant life when I became a Christian? None of my relationships seem to be working out, and I'll never be able to buy a house." She was expecting something to materialise. When it hadn't happened, it was very stressful. It was understandable, I guess, whenever any of us have that happened, when we have expectations that don't come to fulfilment. It's a stressful, difficult thing to adjust to. But where do our expectations come from, and what are they based on, and how realistic are they? And are they even Christian? My friend had heard the term abundant life, and in her particular church, they taught her what to expect. That abundant life meant that she was to have good relationships all round and material success as well. So that's what she was thinking. My second question is, what were they thinking? Because something like this that I'd seen and you've heard about in my friend was still going on with the apostles when they met with Jesus 6 or 7 weeks after he was raised from the dead, just before he stopped appearing among them and ascended to heaven, as we heard in tonight's gospel reading. They had ideas about God's kingdom and the nature of the Messiah, which they'd picked up from the Jewish background that they were all brought up in. Ideas about how God's anointed Messiah would save his people, would boot out the Romans, would make Israel great again, make her the world's number one nation, just like back in David and Solomon's time, when they had the best trade deals and their international influence was undisputed, and where they all had jobs, and when their GDP was outstripping everyone else's, as the wealth of the nations had at that time flowed in to Jerusalem, where their kings were enthroned in glorious array. And because their kings at that time had been like that, and because their kings were known as anointed ones or messiahs, God's messianic leaders, that's what the disciples expected in the Messiah that they were waiting for. We get the same, or we get some of that flavour of what they believed in from their earlier interactions with Jesus in the Gospels. Jesus started teaching something which is familiar to us, but which was unfamiliar to them. He began to teach them at one point in his ministry that he was going to suffer and be betrayed and to die in Jerusalem. Peter was so shocked that he tried to nip this new teaching in the bud. He didn't want anything that connected suffering and the Messiah. And Jesus teaches the same thing in new settings as they, as a group, progress towards Jerusalem. But we're told the disciples didn't understand the saying and they were afraid to ask. Later on, even as the band of disciples were heading up the road together to Jerusalem, two others of the disciples, James and John, asked if they could have the most prominent places at Jesus' immediate right and left once he's made king. So once again, we see that their thinking is about ruling alongside Jesus in the newly founded kingdom as sort of something like his chiefs of staff, his right-hand men. And it wasn't just their thought, as if they were sort of, you know, an isolated couple in an otherwise understanding group, because the other 10 disciples were outraged at James and John. Not because those two had made their request, but because if they got what they wanted, then the other 10 would certainly be relegated to less prominent positions as a result. The kingdom meant that Israel would be made great again, they all wanted great positions in that new regime. So that's what they were thinking. And in the gospel, in tonight's reading from Acts, we get a sort of a whiff of this thinking yet again along those lines, even after Jesus has by this time suffered and died and been raised. He tells them to wait in Jerusalem for the coming Holy Spirit. But the apostles ask, Lord, will you at this time restore the kingdom to Israel? They'd been through a lot with him, hadn't they? They'd had their understanding changed around, and they'd actually been through a lot in terms of action as well, insofar as they'd seen what had happened to him just a month and a half before. They'd seen him suffer. They'd seen him crucified. Maybe they were just thinking, this has got to be the time when the kingdom comes. Lord, is this the time? You've been talking about the kingdom now these preceding 6 or 7 weeks. What we see instead is that while they're still thinking about Israel getting restored and the former glory being located at Jerusalem Central, Jesus is instead outlining for them a new role, not with Jerusalem as the destination, but as the starting point of a mission flowing out through Judea and Samaria and to the ends of the earth. How did the disciples process all this? I don't want to give the impression that I think the disciples were stupid, that they were somehow a bit thick. In fact, I think they were just remarkable to be able to make that transition in their mindset and in their expectations, and to still leave a record of how long it took them and how hard it was to do what they did. As we have, their earlier dullness is still clearly recorded in the Gospels. It's quite remarkable. They didn't, in the portrait that was laid out, they laid it out warts and all about themselves. And they did, after all, change. Not an instant, just like that sort of change, but over time they did change. Or I should say better, God changed them over time. Think about Peter. Put yourself in his shoes. How humiliating would it have been to have pledged publicly this undying loyalty to Jesus, but to then have been found to have denied him at the end? I reckon he would have just been totally shattered. If that were you, I'm sure you would be just shaken to the core. But it turns out that even this humbling activity in his life was in God's plan. Jesus' prayer for him, "Simon, Simon, listen. Satan demanded to have you that he might sift you like wheat. But I've prayed for you that your faith might not fail. And when you have turned again, strengthen your brothers." What a turnaround it was. From this person who, well, he'd betrayed his master, but he'd betrayed the thing that he'd stated he would do. In a way, he'd betrayed himself. What a turnaround in Acts as a witness in that unfolding mission. We find that Peter and the apostles, Peter, who wanted to excise suffering from the role of the Messiah, Peter and the apostles, now subject to suffering, at the end of it all, rejoiced that they were counted worthy to suffer for Christ's name. Like, they really did change, and there's something very admirable about them and God's activity in changing them. There's Peter again from tonight's reading from 1 Peter, chapters 4 and 5. And what he's doing is he's turned and he's now strengthening his brothers and sisters. He's writing that letter to the exiled, persecuted Christians in what today is called Turkey, helping them not to be surprised. Not to be surprised as he was earlier on, back before they got to Jerusalem, when Jesus introduced that teaching about suffering. Helping them to reframe what's happening to them, not as something strange, but instead teaching them to humble themselves under God's almighty hand. Reminding them that the God who called them in the past cares for them in the present and holds out a future for them alive. The third section is this question, which you might like to put to yourself. So what are we thinking? What are you thinking? Why do you reckon God chose to do what he did with the apostles? If God revealed himself in history and ultimately made himself known in the history of Jesus, this means that those who were historically with Jesus from the beginning of his public ministry to the time of his being taken up from them occupy a unique historic role in our relationship with God. God changed the apostles so that they would be able to see with new eyes that Jesus as Messiah redefined God's saving action, turned upside down their views of greatness, and broke down the myth that God's favour is just insurance for a happy, healthy, wealthy life, a life free of suffering. Why do you reckon God chose to do what he did with the apostles? The early Christian communities that immediately followed on from the time of the apostles were faced with many challenges in the first centuries. To get through these things and to figure out how to live and how to believe faithfully in new contexts, they kept referring back to the apostolic witness. Lots of heresies rose up, teaching things that were at odds with what the apostles had taught about Jesus. So the litmus test for these new, growing, developing Christian communities all through the known world was, is that apostolic? And by this they were meaning, has this always been taught from the apostles' time in all the churches, in every place since the beginning of the gospel? And as they asked that question and reflected and thought, they made best use of those apostles and their witness and their testimony and what God had wrought in their understanding for themselves in this new and developing faith. And by this means, the apostolic truth and witness of the apostles protected their faith. I guess I've got a high view of the apostles. I don't subscribe to the idea that anyone who calls himself an apostle is necessarily an apostle. I don't subscribe to the view that apostles who didn't spend that time with Jesus and have his impact on them and have their minds changed and their understanding enlarged. I don't believe that somebody calling themselves an apostle without that kind of qualification really measures up. The apostolic truth protects our faith. Over time, that's how the New Testament writings were clarified. Some so-called gospels were not recognised as apostolic. For example, the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Barnabas. The creeds, as faithful summaries of the essentials of Christian faith, were developed and accepted in the early church, but always through reference back to the apostolic witness to Jesus' life and teaching. I guess what I'm getting at is that when we get away from using the apostolic testimony about Jesus, then if we're going to follow Jesus, it's going to be possibly being bewitched by a different Jesus and a different gospel. We might end up with something very different to what the apostles intended to hand down through their testimony. In fact, that's what had happened to the friend of mine who I mentioned at the start. She felt devastated that she was not having the abundant life that she expected to have. But just as God had changed the apostles' mindset and expanded their understanding, so God, through the apostles, over time brought her back to the truth as the apostolic testimony about Jesus did its work in her, freeing her from the false idea that the gospel was somehow just a prop for human prosperity. We humans, have a great capacity demonstrated to corrupt our relationship with the divine in every age. We need to beware. And while we live in this age between Christ's ascension and his return, God has given us the apostolic witness and teaching as a foundation for our faith. May it be our guide in living for Christ. Amen.